Thank you. Good evening. My name is Arne Westad. I'm one of the two directors of LSE Ideas with Professor Michael Cox, and I'm going to be the chair tonight. It's a great pleasure for us to introduce Professor Alan Gulso from Gettysburg College, where he's the Henry Luce Professor of the Civil War era. I also want to acknowledge the support that we get for this series from the Gilda Lehmann Institute for American History. They have a wonderful program. I encourage all of you to visit their website. It's probably the most instructive single website there is on American history, particularly in the 19th century, but also in the early 20th century. And they do fantastic work in the States, and now here as well, through this lecture series and other activities that they are supporting in the UK. So we're very grateful to them for the support. But first and foremost, of course, we are grateful to Professor Gulso for coming and lecturing here tonight. Professor Gulso is one of the most renowned US intellectual historians of his generation. In fact, he's moved much beyond intellectual history in terms of the areas that he's been covering. Let me just mention some of his publications from the last decade or so. A wonderful survey of the Civil War and the Reconstruction era, published in 1995, The Crisis of the American Republic. Abraham Lincoln, probably your first work on Lincoln, I think, in 1999. Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President. Then in 2004, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, which will be referred to in today's lecture. And then this year, Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America. So it's a very broad and fascinating publication record that Professor Gulso has. Now, Abraham Lincoln is one of those seminal figures in American history, with a lot of resonance for what has been happening after his time, as well as what he did when he was president of the United States. Some of you will remember Doris Kearns Goodwin's lecture here last year, her book, Team of Rivals, which of course has a resonance in terms of what the current president-elect is trying to do with his cabinet, placing his rivals within it rather than criticizing him on the outside. So Lincoln's relevance is fairly broad for contemporary America as well. But there is one issue in particular where I have found Lincoln to be of particular value to the debates about the United States today. And that is exactly what this lecture is going to deal with. How to deal with problems of democracy in a time of war, problems civil rights, problems that have to do with civil liberties. And this is, of course, one of the standards against which I think the current administration, but also the current debate in many ways in the United States, have quite a bit to learn from what was going on in the United States during the Civil War and what Lincoln was trying to do in balancing law and liberty when he was fighting for the survival of his republic. So the contemporary relevance of this is quite significant. And this is what Professor Gulso will be discussing with us tonight. He will focus in on Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, but with a very significant subtitle, Law and Liberty in a Time of War. Professor Gulso, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to LSE, and we're looking forward to hearing your lecture.
Thank you, Professor Westad. It is something for which I'm very grateful to have an opportunity to speak to you here tonight and speak in London. Sydney Smith once said that anyone who was tired of London was probably tired of life, and I'm only too happy to agree with that. From my youngest days, I have read about London. My imagination's always been captured by art and music concerned with London. How curious it is that it should be Abraham Lincoln that brings me at last to London. But you know, he is here, after a fashion, because the only statue on Parliament Square, which is not of a parliamentary or Commonwealth figure, is one of Abraham Lincoln. Alas, as I discovered this afternoon, nobody on the staff of any of the great buildings around Parliament Square seems to be aware of that. In fact, since there are lots of construction projects going forward, with the buildings immediately behind him, it's actually rather difficult to find the statue of Lincoln in his present situation. But we did manage to discover it, and it did give me that sense that, well, he has been here to blaze a path, so I'm not coming as an entirely unknown, speaking about a subject or personality entirely unknown. Taken at simple face value, the Emancipation Proclamation that Abraham Lincoln released on the 1st of January, 1863, is probably the single most revolutionary pronouncement ever signed by an American president. It struck the legal shackles from 4 million black slaves and set the American Republic's face toward the total abolition of slavery within 3 more years, some 30 years after slavery was abolished in the British West Indies and throughout the empire. The author of the Emancipation Proclamation regarded it as the central act of my administration and the great event of the 19th century. But today, the Emancipation Proclamation is probably best known for what people think it didn't do, or what it avoided doing. People love the second inaugural of Lincoln's. People memorize the Gettysburg Address, but they suspect that the Emancipation Proclamation was a legal sham, or simply a trick played by Lincoln to cast the breakaway Southern Confederacy as the evil protectors of human slavery, and thus make the American Civil War look like some kind of great moral crusade. This odd dissatisfaction with the Emancipation Proclamation begins with the language of the proclamation, because it simply lacks the eloquent flourish of the Gettysburg Address or the Second Inaugural Address. The Emancipation Proclamation had, in Richard Hofstadter's savage but memorable phrase, all the moral grandeur of a bill of lading. But this dissatisfaction with Lincoln's style spreads from style to suggest, rather darkly, that Lincoln's heart had never been in emancipation in the first place. Where he has no power, Mr. Lincoln will set the Negroes free. Where he retains power, he will consider them as slaves, smirked the Times of London in one of its less prescient moments. The proclamation was a mere political gesture, proclaimed the Times, with no real force, like a Chinaman beating his two swords together to frighten his enemy. Casting the Emancipation Proclamation as a document of disappointment rather than of freedom may seem at first like moving too fast. There we are. Well, now that I've given everything away, we can all go.
Yeah.
Isn't it terrible that that happens, huh? Casting the Emancipation Proclamation as a document of disappointment instead of a document of freedom may seem at first little more than another one of those perverse instances in which modern American historians try, as David Hackett Fisher once recently put it, to make the American past into a record of crime and folly, full of racist sound and oppressive fury, signifying nothing but stories of victimization. But in the case of the Emancipation Proclamation, this skepticism about the document has really been around for a long time. Longer, in fact, than even Richard Hofstadter's acid comparison of the proclamation to a bill of lading. And what's more, it's a skepticism that has a certain rationale to it. After all, why was the proclamation's language so bland? Why did Lincoln wait almost 2 years into the Civil War to issue it? What were his real motives? These kinds of questions are not just cheap shots. They go to the heart, not just of the Emancipation Proclamation, but to the place that Lincoln and the Civil War occupy in American history. Now, the American Civil War, just to put it in a nutshell, began on April 12, 1861, when the army of the newly organized Confederate States opened fire on the federal troops garrisoning Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor and forced them to surrender. The Emancipation Proclamation, in its final form, was signed by Abraham Lincoln on January 1st, 1863. So the most obvious fact about the Emancipation Proclamation that raises questions in people's minds is this matter of timing. Why did he wait so long? Actually, the question is not even as simple as that, because inside that question is another one, the real question. If the American Civil War was really a war against slavery, or at least against an insurgent movement protecting slavery, and if Lincoln was in earnest about emancipating slaves, then why didn't he pick up his pen at 9 o'clock on the morning of April 13th, 1861, and proclaim the Confederacy's slaves free then? If Lincoln really meant what he said when he wrote that, "I have always hated slavery," then why didn't he act at once? Why does it look as though Lincoln dallied for another year and a half, trying every other way to put down the rebellion and win the war without touching slavery? As the one-time black militant, Julius Lester, asked in 1968, how come it took him 2 whole years to free the slaves? His pen was sitting on his desk the whole time. All he had to do was to get up one morning and say, "Doggone it, I think I'm going to free the slaves today. It just ain't right for folks to own other folks." It was that simple. There were many factors, said Lester, which led to the Emancipation Proclamation, and it is not only misleading but a lie to depict Lincoln as the great emancipator. Now, of course, one easy answer to this skepticism, especially to Julius Lester's skepticism, is to point out that it might not have done much good for Lincoln to have issued a freedom proclamation on April 13th, 1861, because the slaves he would have tried to free were at that moment beyond his power. They belonged to another country, if you accept the Confederates' interpretation of themselves. Or they were in the hands of outlaws and insurgents, if you accept Lincoln's interpretation. And you simply don't liberate property from outlaws or insurgents by shouting, "Free!" Doesn't happen that way. But this is not a very convincing answer when you realize that a year and a half later, that is pretty much what Lincoln did. And it certainly doesn't satisfy critics who point out that even if he couldn't exactly free slaves in the Confederacy because they were beyond his reach, then why didn't he, in the Emancipation Proclamation, free the slaves in the 4 border states, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, which stayed in the Union? Couldn't he have emancipated slaves in those states? Well, let's take all these questions in reverse so we can move from the most specific to the most general. Couldn't Lincoln have moved immediately to free the slaves, at least of the border states? The answer to that question is no. In the first place, the American Federal Constitution does not grant American presidents the plenary power to do anything they please, even if it's for the very best of reasons. In the second place, bear in mind that in the 1860s, before the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution, and before the creation of an incorporation doctrine that firmly subordinated state law to federal authority, a legal and constitutional firewall separated the jurisdictions of the American federal and state governments to a degree we would find simply incredible today. In the third place, slavery, surprisingly, was not a creation of federal law in the American Union. It was the creation of individual state enactments. And so long as that was the case, neither the president nor the Congress as the federal government had the power to reach over that constitutional firewall and to touch slavery. So if Lincoln had tried to issue a proclamation freeing slaves anywhere in the United States, the next morning, federal courthouses would have been swarming with slave owners from the border states filing lawsuits and demanding injunctions. And at the head of the federal judiciary sat the Chief Justice of the United States. I am going to learn how to use this thing yet. Either it's going to win or I'm going to win, but one or the other of us is not leaving this room tonight. At the head of the federal judiciary sat the Chief Justice of the United States, Roger Brooke Tawney. So any cases that went on appeal into the federal system against Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation would have appeared before the same Roger Tawney who in 1857 had handed down the notorious decision in Dred Scott versus Sanford, denying the federal government the power to restrict the spread of slavery in the Western territories. The same Roger Tawney who would use Ex parte Merriman in 1861 and prize cases in 1863 to obstruct the Lincoln administration's entire arsenal of war-making powers. Tawney had, in fact, already prepared in advance a hostile judicial opinion of what he anticipated to be a move by Lincoln to emancipate slaves. And Tawney would have welcomed a decree from Lincoln as an opportunity to drive a constitutional stake through the heart of emancipation. So, no presidential proclamations about slavery, at least until 1863. That answer, however, only satisfies the last and the most specific of these questions. We're not anywhere near answering the next big question, which is, why did Lincoln reverse himself then in 1863 and actually issue a presidential proclamation proclaiming freedom to the slaves in the Confederacy? Nor have we got close to the biggest question of all, because the real point behind all of these questions is whether Lincoln was sincere about eliminating slavery. Proving that he did nothing in 1861 about slavery because he had no power to do so in either the border states or the Confederacy only answers our last question. It doesn't speak to whether he really wanted to emancipate the slaves. But there is an answer to that question, and it lies not in issuing proclamations, but in a more subtle strategy for emancipation, which he began implementing not in 1863, but in November of 1861, when the Civil War was only 7 months old. As one of the four border states, slavery was legal in the state of Delaware. But it was also marginal there. In 1860, only some 1,700 slaves were still held in bondage there. These slaves were held in their slavery, free from federal interference, because of the constitutional firewall. But there was nothing that prevented the Delaware state legislature from emancipating them. And if the Delaware state legislature did so, the constitutional firewall would act the other way and prevent the federal courts from having any say in the matter. The key then was finding a way to leverage a slave state legislature like that of Delaware's into emancipating its slaves on its own. Now, the secession of the Confederate States narrowed Lincoln's options for testing this plan to those four border states that remained loyal to the Union. But this was exactly the kind of plan Lincoln proposed to try. And to try in Delaware in the fall of 1861 by drawing up a federal buyout plan. This does begin to sound familiar. Buyout, bailout. Maybe we're setting a precedent. The idea was that Congress would authorize dangling the bait of $700,000 in United States bonds before the Delaware legislature to finance a compensated buyout of the state's slaveholders. Now, assuming that the Delaware legislature took the bait, not only would this make emancipation court-proof, but it would commence a domino effect. Most Delaware slaveholders could be expected to take the money and free their slaves. But those who didn't would have nowhere to go but to the three other border states and sell their slaves there. As they did, they increased the supply of slaves in those three states. And obeying the law of what happens to prices when supply is increased, that would drive the value of slaves down. If Lincoln turns next to Maryland, which bordered Delaware, and offered Maryland slaveholders the same buyout plan, panicky slaveholders who noticed their slave assets losing value would grab the buyout, triggering the same spillover into neighboring Kentucky and Missouri. And then Lincoln could turn to Kentucky and Missouri and repeat the process, and thus slavery would disappear from at least those four slave states, and all without bitter ender slaveholders having any way of appealing to the federal courts. There would also be an additional benefit further south. When the Confederate states realized that their border state sisters were opting for emancipation. In other words, were repudiating the slavery that the Confederacy had been founded to protect, the demoralizing effect would be enormous. Lincoln believed that the Confederacy's survival hinged on whether the insurgents could inveigle the border states into joining their Confederacy and staking the Confederacy's boundaries so far north that the federal government could never hope to conquer them. But if the border states opted for emancipation, any hope of the border joining the Confederacy was kaput. The rebels would then realize that the strategic deck was stacked against them and sue for peace terms. Peace terms which could, conceivably, incorporate the same federal buyout strategy which had worked in the border. And through all this, Chief Justice Taney could twiddle his thumbs. If Congress will pass a law authorizing the issuance of bonds for the payment of the emancipated Negroes in the border states, Lincoln cheerfully assured his old friend, Judge David Davis, then Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri will accept the terms. And once that was accomplished, Lincoln was quite sure that gradual emancipation and governmental compensation would bring slavery to an end. Lincoln's confidence in his compensated emancipation scheme explains not only why he made no effort to issue an emancipation proclamation before 1863, but also it explains why he resisted the efforts of others to install rival but far less dependable emancipation programs of their own. The war was little more than a month old when, on May 23rd, 1861, the voters of the state of Virginia ratified the decision of its secession convention to leave the Union and join the Confederacy. The same day, Union troops stationed at Fortress Monroe, the last federal outpost left in Virginia, struck out on their own and cleared the immediate vicinity of the fort around Hampton, Virginia. The inhabitants of Hampton fled, leaving their slaves behind them. And when the soldiers returned to the fort that evening, crowds of hopeful slaves followed them there. Three of these slaves were eventually brought before Fortress Monroe's commandant, Major General Benjamin Franklin Butler. Butler was a political general from Massachusetts, whose record in politics had never showed much inclination toward abolition. But Butler saw at once in the three slaves an opportunity to strike a blow at both slavery and the Confederacy. He declared that he was seizing these three slaves as what he called contraband of war, and put them to gainful employment on the post in the same way he might have put any other useful contraband of war into the service of the Union. Now this, of course, was a good legal joke. Goods and material can be contraband of war, but not people. Unless, of course, the sort of people in question are regarded as being no different from goods and materials. In which case, the joke was very much on the rebels who had bought and sold people as though they were goods and materials. But it was a joke with real consequences. 2 days later, there were eight more such contrabands waiting for Butler. The next day, there were 47. Butler wrote out receipts for them and sent the receipts to their masters. The Confederates were not amused by the receipts, and neither was Lincoln, though for very different reasons. In the first place, by July of 1861, General Butler had 900 contrabands on his hands at Fortress Monroe, and less work, room, and food for them. But more important in Lincoln's mind was the legal message the contraband designation was implying. Under international law, contraband was what one seized from enemy nations in time of war. But Lincoln's whole argument against the Confederacy was that secession was a legal impossibility. In fact, it was an act of outlawry. And so the Confederacy could not be regarded in law as a nation. And the war he was waging could only be regarded as resistance to an insurrection. However, if the war was only a domestic insurrection, then seizing Southerners' goods as contraband might allow the Supreme Court to move in at once with some form of injunction. And even if Butler could have persuaded the courts of the legality of seizing these slaves as contraband, there was nothing in the law of contraband which necessarily dispossessed slaveholders of title to their contraband property. The possession of real property in a belligerent, warned Henry W. Halleck, the Union General-in-Chief and a former lawyer and author of a textbook on international law, the possession of real property by a belligerent gives him a right to its use and its products, but not a completely valid and indefeasible title with full power of alienation. That meant that once the insurrection was over, slave owners might have a full right to reclaim their slaves, and any emancipation that it was thought they enjoyed would be a dead letter. So contraband? Not quite the solution it looked like on the surface. A similar problem occurred in the West that summer. In August of 1861, Lincoln's hot-headed department commander in Missouri, John Charles Fremont, tried to suppress a rebel guerrilla uprising by declaring martial law in the state of Missouri, and under the umbrella of his martial law authority, declaring the slaves of any rebels free. Abolitionists, inside and outside Lincoln's party, rejoiced, but not Lincoln. For one thing, in 1861, Missouri and the other border states were still sitting on the fence. And to allow a department commander to push, by a premature political decision, Missouri and the others into the arms of the Confederacy would be to hazard the whole enterprise of the war. But more to the point was Lincoln's legal skepticism about the force of martial law. Americans had fought only two wars since their revolution, and in only one instance had an American general resorted to declaring martial law. For all practical purposes, there was no American jurisprudence about how martial law was to operate. And Lincoln rightly feared that this was exactly the sort of situation which would generate appeals to the federal courts and a ripe feast for Chief Justice Taney. So Lincoln canceled Fremont's proclamation and cashiered the general. And when another general, David Hunter, tried to issue a similar proclamation in the occupied districts of the Carolinas, Lincoln revoked that one too. So, no martial law emancipation proclamations. Lincoln had similar reasons for doubting the force of a third alternative emancipation strategy. This time, a plan hatched in Congress in the form of the First and Second Confiscation Acts. The Confiscation Acts were designed by Illinois Senator Lyman Trumbull to strike at the ways the Confederates were using their slave population to further their war effort through building fortifications, through teamster and camp duties, through work in armaments factories, all of which freed white Southerners for Confederate Army service. Trumbull's Confiscation Act declared the property of rebel masters confiscated. But there was less bite to the Confiscation Acts than it seemed. For one thing, the Confiscation Acts confiscated slaves, but did not actually emancipate them. For another, confiscation, like the seizure of contraband, looked a great deal like the law of prize on the high seas. And that placed the United States government in the awkward position of applying against Confederate slave ownership yet another legal device which was supposed to exist only between sovereign nations. And the one thing that Lincoln kept on insisting was that the Confederacy could not legally be a sovereign nation. Lincoln signed both of the Confiscation Acts, but grudgingly. He warned Congress that confiscation ran the risk of being overturned on constitutional grounds, and in fact, he did next to nothing to enforce the acts. But in none of these cases, contrabands, martial law emancipations, or the Confiscation Acts, was Lincoln's reluctance about emancipation itself. What worried him, instead, was whether these alternatives to his buyout plan could pass judicial muster. And he was convinced that they could not. But the buyout plan turned out to have problems entirely of its own. Because he had been born in a border state, Kentucky, Lincoln believed that he possessed an intuitive understanding of how border state slaveholders thought and what kind of incentives would work on them. And in this, he could not have been more wrong. Not only did the Delaware legislature refuse to rise to the buyout bait, but in the spring of 1862, the congressional delegations from Kentucky, Missouri, and Maryland tossed the compensation plan into the waste bin. As a veteran of many a legislative battle, the most likely conclusion for Lincoln to draw from this was to try again at the next session, either next year or whenever the next state legislative session met. But that required time. And time was what Lincoln suddenly found himself perilously short of in 1862. The reason time evaporated in Lincoln's hands lay with the Union Army, or rather, the commander of the Army of the Potomac, Major General George B. McClellan. Unlike Fremont or Hunter, McClellan was stubbornly opposed to emancipation. He cultivated close ties to Lincoln's political opposition, and he was arrogant enough to drop indiscreet hints about the need for a military dictator in this crisis, or even some kind of political intervention by the army. Then, the idea was that working as a kind of proconsul, McClellan would negotiate some kind of agreeable peace arrangement with the Confederacy. In July of 1862, at almost the same time that the border states were turning down the compensated emancipation plan, McClellan presented Lincoln with a letter warning Lincoln that military power should not be allowed to interfere with the relations of servitude, either by supporting or impairing the authority of the master. Otherwise, said McClellan, a declaration of radical views, especially upon slavery, will rapidly disintegrate our armies. This was a very delicate but a very definite suggestion that Lincoln back off from any further emancipation initiatives. Significantly, for those who like to criticize Lincoln for half-heartedness on the subject of emancipation, it was a hint he refused to take. 2 weeks after McClellan handed his letter to Lincoln, President Lincoln laid before his cabinet what has become known as the first draft of an Emancipation Proclamation. This was an odd shift of tactics for a president who only a year before had been willing to cashier a general for trying to emancipate slaves by proclamation. But the failure of the border states to rise to his offer and the threat posed by McClellan and the army left Lincoln with no practical choice. Unless he was willing to see McClellan seize the reins of government, emancipation had to be wedged into public policy as quickly and directly as the situation permitted, and the only real option was a presidential emancipation proclamation. At least in his capacity as president, Lincoln had more constitutional room to maneuver than Fremont or Hunter had as generals in their military departments. The Constitution designates the President of the United States as, simultaneously, the Commander-in-Chief of the armed services in time of war. And in war, the President was supposed to possess a set of war powers, which occupied a vague and untested middle ground between martial law and civil law. The problem for Lincoln was that this presumption had a shaky history. The only body of opinion which actually described these war powers were a series of comments made by John Quincy Adams on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1836 and again in 1841 and 1842. Many other legal commentators hotly denied that any such war powers existed in the Constitution. But the notion refused to die And it was with these war powers in mind that Lincoln composed the first draft of his Emancipation Proclamation and presented it to his cabinet. Because we think we know what an Emancipation Proclamation ought to do, it ought to free the slaves, no question about that. Because we think we know what a proclamation like this should do, it has been easy to focus on what Lincoln's proclamation did not do, because it clearly did not emancipate all of the slaves of the United States. It did not, to begin with, emancipate the slaves of the border states, nor did it emancipate any of the slaves in those districts of the Confederacy which had come under federal occupation. But peculiar as this exception seems, the legal reasons for it were quite obvious. Lincoln's war powers, whatever they were, only could apply constitutionally to the places where there was a war in process. The border states had never been at war with the federal government, and so no war powers could be asserted there unless Lincoln wanted to see his proclamation end up in Roger Tawney's lap. And since it had been Lincoln's argument all along that secession from the Union was a legal impossibility, then the reclaimed and occupied districts of the Confederacy were not at war either. If Lincoln wanted his proclamation to stick in law, then he would have to zone off the border states and the occupied districts and their slaves. But in the states of the Confederacy, which even at this point he refused to even dignify by calling them the Confederacy, he only would use the circumlocution any state or states wherein the constitutional authority of the United States shall not be then practically recognized, those slaves were another matter. Having removed themselves from civil jurisdiction, the Confederate states now operated under the war powers of the President as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. And under the rubric of those powers, Lincoln was prepared to do, as President, what under any other circumstances could never have been done legally, and that was to declare a general emancipation. Not just of slaves used in Confederate war service, not just the slaves of rebel masters, but of all the slaves of the Confederacy, without exception, in all rebellious areas. And it declared those emancipated slaves not merely as contraband of war, not merely as confiscated, but permanently free, thenceforward and forever. This was taking a long chance. Instead of preempting General McClellan, an Emancipation Proclamation might just have as easily triggered the intervention that McClellan whispered about. But General McClellan proved no more adept at political strategy than he had been at military strategy. And when McClellan finally defied his own expectations and defeated the Confederate Army at Antietam in the fall of 1862, Lincoln issued the proclamation in preliminary form. When McClellan balked at undertaking any further military action, Lincoln successfully sacked him once and for all, and the proclamation went into effect on the 1st of January, 1863. Lincoln's political purposes in the war always pointed in the direction of emancipation. Emancipation, wrote Lincoln's congressional ally and biographer Isaac Arnold in 1866, was Lincoln's deepest, strongest desire of the soul. And from the time of his election, Lincoln had hoped and expected to be the liberator of slaves. Lincoln was only dubious about the competing legal mechanisms of emancipation, not emancipation itself. Now, true as it is that the proclamation is couched in a legalese strangely different from the eloquence of Lincoln's other famous papers, it cannot be said often enough that this was intended to be a legal document so that it could have real legal consequences. What is the point, I wonder, of accusing a document of sounding too legal when its purpose is legal. So much for the Bill of Lading. The Emancipation Proclamation might be fully as prosaic as the Gettysburg Address was memorable. But the Gettysburg Address, of course, only dedicated a cemetery. Whereas the Emancipation Proclamation changed the legal status of 4 million slaves who are and henceforward shall be free. Now, it did not, I know, actually liberate any Southern slaves until the Union armies marched far enough across the South to make it effectual. Nor did it liberate slaves in places where the federal government was sovereign, as in the border states and the occupied Confederacy. But no one believes, in the first case, that law, even martial law, lacks meaning only because enforcement has yet to catch up with it. Anyone who hasn't quite grasped that just needs to step out into the middle of London traffic. Just because you've got a law and hasn't yet been enforced doesn't mean that it doesn't exist as a law. Just try breaking a few of them. I keep hearing sirens honking back and forth. I keep wondering, who are they after now? What trespasser? Someone who has not looked left. Like myself, I keep looking to the right and I keep being very nearly run over. London has great attractions, but also great hazards. That seems to be one of them. I don't want to come to a very unpleasant end on the front of a bus. It just wouldn't look nice. So, no one really believes that a law, simply because you haven't enforced it yet, doesn't have any meaning. And no one allowed at that time that the federal power had the constitutional right to impose emancipation where federal courts were open and functioning. By the way, the people who are so enamored of deploring the Emancipation Proclamation because it is this moral grandeur of a Bill of Lading kind of document really need to consult the proclamations of Generals Fremont and Hunter. They'll find out when they do that those proclamations were equally legal, technical, and prosaic. Yet no one among the legions of Lincoln's critics is inclined to fault them on this score. Set Fremont and Hunter's proclamations side by side with Lincoln's proclamation, and you'll very soon find yourself yearning for the Bill of Lading. Forgetting these contexts and these comparisons has made it, unhappily, possible to focus exclusively on the tiniest of the proclamation's leaves and ignore the testimony of the forest to three home truths about Lincoln and emancipation. The first of these home truths is this: Lincoln was not pushed reluctantly toward emancipation by noble or far-seeing abolitionists who were further ahead of the curve of history than he was. Lincoln was already on his own path toward emancipation. And if he was pushed in any way toward an emancipation proclamation, it was by emancipation's enemies, like McClellan, who looked like they were gathering strength to kill the emancipation project once and for all. Secondly, the Emancipation Proclamation was not a sentimental trick to enlist the sympathy of the North or the European nations or the abolitionists for a war effort which was flagging. Because who exactly was being tricked? Far from waiting to be fooled by Lincoln's cleverness into rallying around the Emancipation Proclamation, the Northern public was largely hostile to emancipation. And 6 weeks after the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation was issued, Northern voters administered one of the most punishing electoral rebukes any majority political party has ever sustained in Congress. The November 1862 congressional by-elections cost Lincoln's party 31 seats in the House of Representatives. So much for lagging behind public opinion. Thirdly, Lincoln did not issue the Emancipation Proclamation as a political device for his supposedly real objective, saving the Union. Saving the Union, as Lincoln and the Confederates both knew very well, was the only way to ensure that Southern slaveholders could be pinned into place, bargained out of their slaves by Lincoln's compensated emancipation plan, and forced to let their people go. Why else did the Confederate States secede from the Union, if not to escape the bonds of the Union, which they knew in Lincoln's hands would set slavery on a downhill path from which it could never return? Frederick Douglass, the black abolitionist, once remarked that if you viewed Lincoln from the most extreme abolitionist position, then indeed this author of gradual compensated emancipation looked tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. This requires belief, however, in a vision of immediate and absolute abolition that never had a chance under heaven of succeeding. But, added Frederick Douglass, looked at from the viewpoint of the average American, North and South, Lincoln was in fact swift, zealous, radical, and determined. It was a determination with the flexibility to consider more than one path, but it was also a determination that did not propose ever to negotiate the fact of emancipation. "While I remain in my present position," he told Congress 11 months later, "I shall not attempt to retract or modify the Emancipation Proclamation, nor shall I return to slavery any person who is free by the terms of that proclamation." He repeated that declaration a year later, adding that if the people should, by whatever mode or means, make it an executive duty to re-enslave such persons, another, and not I, must be their instrument to perform it. And that was a promise that he kept to the very end. Thank you very much. Now, I understand from Professor Westad that we're going to have a question time, and I think I'll lead off by asking a question of myself, which of course also appears, as I discovered this evening, a little bit without any warning, that what connection can we possibly draw between the victory of Senator Obama and Abraham Lincoln? As I said, this was a question I first met in the elevator coming up in the other building. I thought, oh, well, maybe I should have lectured about that, but of course, well, you know, I just can't do that. So what about Senator Obama and Senator Lincoln, and Mr. President Lincoln? Well, everyone says, and this is what I've been hearing for weeks and weeks and months, everyone says, well, look, here's Obama, he's from Illinois. And wasn't Lincoln from Illinois? Well, here's Obama, he's a lawyer. Well, wasn't Lincoln a lawyer? Here's Obama, he's got a great way with words. Lincoln had a great way with words, doesn't that make him like Lincoln? And of course, Obama is an African-American. He's a descendant from someone of African birth. Doesn't that somehow link him with Lincoln, because Lincoln liberated people who were of African descent? So you kind of put all these things together, which stood by themselves, don't really look all that imposing, and somehow they're greater than the sum of their parts, and people then come up with this wonderful equation which says Obama equals Lincoln. And this has been seen in a variety of ways, including even visually. There was a cartoon that appeared in USA Today just after the election. And on the one hand, it showed Martin Luther King kind of patting Obama on the back, and Abraham Lincoln on the other side kind of patting Obama on the back. And I thought, well, considering the unhappy ends visited on Dr. King and President Lincoln, is that really what we wanted? Is that the message we really wanted to send? You know, there's a way you can take these comparisons to unpleasant consequences. So what about this comparison of Lincoln and Obama? Is all of this on course? Is this really something of substance? Well, the irony of this, of course, is that the very first person, the most important person to question the linkage between Obama and Lincoln was Senator Obama himself. In 2005, Time magazine ran a special Lincoln-themed issue. And among other things, they solicited contributions, kind of opinion contributions, from a variety of people about what Lincoln means to them. And Senator Obama's contribution basically said, well, you know, as an African American, I really don't see a whole lot in Lincoln to be enthusiastic about. Okay, I guess we file that one away and we see what comes of it. So the first person to raise a question about these connections, actually, is Senator Obama himself, oddly enough. But let me go on to some of the other issues that are raised about these connections. There is a part of me which, as a history person, wants very much to applaud any effort between drawing connections from the past to the present, because that kind of makes our profession look good. On the other hand, I'm also keenly aware, precisely as a history person, that when you're comparing people who are separated by 150 years, it can very easily wind up being a case of apples and oranges. And, well, let me develop some of this, and you draw your own conclusions. First of all, this matter that both of them were lawyers. Well, that is true. Both Senator Obama and President Lincoln were lawyers by profession. What is significant is, of course, that Lincoln practiced law for 25 years. He was a trial lawyer. That was how he earned his daily bread. He was a very good trial lawyer. He, by the 1850s, had built up quite a successful practice for himself. He was practicing, in fact, corporate law, and was defending a number of very well-heeled clients, especially the railroad interests, and was doing quite well financially from it, too. Not only was he doing well in the Illinois courts, but a lot of his caseload, a lot of his income, too, had now begun to move into the appeals court. He was also working pretty steadily in the federal district court, and in fact, Lincoln is an attorney of record on 6 cases before the United States Supreme Court from the 1850s. So the man had a steady and really quite comfortable income, a very pleasant property that he owned in Springfield, Illinois, and was really doing quite well as a lawyer. Senator Obama, by contrast, has never really practiced as a trial lawyer. He has actually been much more a law professor than he has been a trial lawyer. And that makes for a very different kind of lawyer, because when you're a law professor, you can tell people what you are going to do. We are going to have a quiz. We are going to give an exam. And they really can't say too much, now, can they? Whereas if you're a trial lawyer in front of a jury, you can't tell the jury what is going to happen. You have to persuade them. And that does create a very different context intellectually for both of these lawyers from Illinois. What's also true about both Senator Obama and President Lincoln is that both came from very humble backgrounds. Lincoln's background, born in a log cabin, very poor family with very little in the way of advantages. That's a story which is really quite well known. And it's a very classic kind of American story of going from rags to riches. Senator Obama similarly begins with a story that is mired in poverty, but he did enjoy at least some advantages that President Lincoln did not. He had, for one thing, a grandmother who was a bank vice president, and was educated in private schools in Hawaii, went to the University of Chicago, went to Harvard Law School. None of those things came Lincoln's way, something which Lincoln was always really kind of bitter about later on in life. Whenever he talked about his education, he described it as defective. He wrote that in a self-composed biography for the Congressional Biographical Dictionary. There was a little line for education, and he simply wrote, where everyone else was writing Yale Law or Harvard Law, he writes defective. I mean, it found a law school by the name of Defective Law School, but I'm quite sure that there are some out there. But for him, that was a very sore point. He never really had that. He said, what I'd always really missed was an opportunity for college education. So there was an opportunity that Lincoln did not have, Senator Obama has had. And that, again, is going to make them two very different kinds of lawyers. Both of them were also state legislators. Both Obama and Lincoln served in the Illinois state legislature, although, again, there's a significant difference here. Lincoln served in the Illinois legislature for 8 consecutive terms, was a major mover and shaker, a leader of the Whig Party on the floor, and really someone who was very skilled at building coalitions and getting bills through the Illinois state legislature. Whereas Senator Obama, in his brief tenure in the Illinois state Senate, was actually absent more often than he was present, actually voted present, neither yes nor no, something like 100 times. So he did not have a very long career as a state legislator. And then, fourthly, and maybe this comes really to the heart of it, both Lincoln and Obama have been advocates for a strong national government. But there is a way to be an advocate for a strong national government, and there is a very different way to be an advocate for a strong national government, because there can be very different ends in view. For Senator Obama, the professed end that he has in view is the promotion of fairness. And he has talked about fairness as a goal in terms of equality of result. Lincoln was much more interested in the equality of opportunity, and what you made of things afterwards was very much up to you. He did not mind saying, as he said in 1860, that he was entirely opposed to a law that prevents someone from getting rich. He wished everybody could get rich, and if you didn't get rich this year, quite literally, he said, better luck next time. So Lincoln is not a man who is celebrating fairness. What he's celebrating is the equality of the starting line rather than the equality of the finishing line. Lincoln also found very different sources of inspiration. Lincoln's fundamental inspirations came from John Stuart Mill, from Sir Herbert Spencer, from John Ramsay McCulloch, from the classical laissez-faire political economists of the 19th century. He is, if anything, the closest cognate to him is the Manchester School of Richard Cobden and John Bright. In fact, Lincoln hanged a portrait of John Bright in his office in the White House during his tenure there. At his death, there was a clipping of a John Bright speech found in Lincoln's wallet. So the closest connection one can find in the 19th century to Abraham Lincoln certainly is in the Mancunians, who were the great promoters of free trade, the great enemies of the Corn Laws. So Lincoln is inspired by that, whereas Obama's inspiration in his own autobiographical writing has been Malcolm X, has been Saul Alinsky, the guru of community organization. And that's a very different intellectual universe. Lastly, I think it's important to say that Lincoln's solution to crisis, to economic crisis, was not less but more capitalism. Capitalism is, as far as Lincoln is concerned, the solution to economic problems. Whereas for Senator Obama, it is precisely runaway, unleashed capitalism which is the problem. And between those two universes, there really is a significant gulf. But would Lincoln be surprised by Obama's election as president? Would he be shocked that a black man is now going to be the 44th president of the United States? Well, on that score, I don't think he would have been terribly surprised after all. When the first black soldiers to wear federal uniforms, paraded in review before the White House, Lincoln's comment very simply was, "That will do." It would work just fine as far as he was concerned. And curiously enough, one last anecdote. Lincoln brought with him from Washington a young man who acted as his valet, a black man named William Johnson. William Johnson did chores for the White House staff. He ran messages for the Department of the Interior. He acted in general as Lincoln's valet and went with Lincoln to Gettysburg on the occasion of Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address. On the way back from Gettysburg, Lincoln developed a mild form of smallpox known as varioloid. Johnson, however, caught the full-blooded disease and died of it in January of 1864. Lincoln arranged for Johnson's burial in the Congressional Cemetery in Washington, paid for the funeral expenses out of his own pocket, and also paid for the headstone on Johnson's grave, which read, quite simply, William Johnson, and then this one word, citizen. Up till that time in American law, and especially after the notorious Dred Scott decision, black people could not be considered citizens of the United States, could not, in fact, enjoy United States passports, could not testify in courts against white people, had to pay taxes, but could not send their children to the schools those taxes paid for. Lincoln, in one word, tosses all that aside. William Johnson, citizen. Would he be surprised by Barack Obama president? No, I don't really think so.
Could I chip in on that question? Because what struck me, we have to speak up there, of course, you have the microphone. What struck me in terms of comparison is not so much in terms of political attitudes as the kind of situation with regard to law and legality in times of war, maybe now with quotation marks, as far as the United States goes, that Obama will inherit from the current administration. And one thing that has really struck me, and I've talked about Lincoln's example quite a few times with regard to this, is exactly the kind of hesitation that you pointed out with regard to the proclamation of emancipation. The respect for the laws that existed, trying to work within the existing legal universe and the obligations of the government, in contrast to the still existing administration's dilemmas in terms of dealing with this, and wrong choices, in my view, that has been made on a number of cases, such as torture, such as protection of prisoners of war, which also came out of a pressure of a situation that was seen not just as a national crisis, but as a real war. And it's that dilemma which really links Obama to Lincoln for me, more than just the symbolism of the occasion. I mean, this will be a real difficulty to restore, wouldn't it? I mean, or do you see it differently?
Well, again, looked at from a very long distance, one can say, here is Lincoln coming into the presidency at a time of great crisis. Here is Obama coming into the presidency at a time of great crisis. Are they really going to need to draw off the same wells of inspiration and of action? But again, there's that nasty bit about being the history person in me, which then pipes up and says, all right, well, we have an economic crisis. Was that crisis like the crisis involving secession in 1860?
Yeah. I was more thinking about the war on terror and the difficulty.
Or the war on terror. I think in the case of, well, let me at least speak to the matter of the economic crisis. To make a good equation of the two, you would quite literally have had to say that the economic crisis was one which has been building for the last 30 years, that everybody knew about it as such, that it didn't just happen very, very rapidly, but in fact had been constantly coming on, and people were debating it back and forth over the course of three decades. You would also have to say that one half of the country had lined up behind one solution, and the other half of the country had lined up behind the other solution, and in fact both of these camps had come to such violent disagreement that one was about to disengage from the other and to launch violent military action against the federal military installations. That was what Lincoln was facing coming in. Now, curiously, even as coming in the period between his election and his inauguration, Lincoln refuses to make any statements. He believed that would be much too inflammatory. So he will refuse completely to make any kind of policy declarations of what direction he's going to take, and people cannot draw anything out of him, precisely because he believes if he does make some statement, no matter what he says, it's going to be misconstructed, misinterpreted, and otherwise used in a manipulative fashion. I think Senator Obama is looking at a situation which is very different. I mean, secession was totally unprecedented. Well, this isn't the first time we've looked at economic crises, and I don't mean to make light of economic crisis, but certainly this is not something entirely new, nor are the methods that can be employed in dealing with it completely novel either. So Senator Obama has pitched in with a will in talking about some of the things he wants to do with this. The curiosity is that Lincoln refused to have anything to say at all for fear of inflaming the situation. I might say too, because Team of Rivals tends to be floating right at the top of people's attention about this. And Obama himself has been asked, well, what are you reading? Well, I'm reading Team of Rivals. And people have speculated from that, well, what Obama's going to do is, in the name of national unity, he's going to create a coalition government. He'll bring opposites together, and somehow from the synthesis of opposing viewpoints, a policy will emerge. Well, again, you know, that nasty, nagging little voice within me says, well, yes, Lincoln created a team, but it wasn't entirely of rivals. There was one person in his cabinet who was quite clearly a rival, and that was Salmon Chase. And Chase never stopped trying to be a rival, and in fact was part of a dump Lincoln movement in 1864. So he's Lincoln, Secretary of the Treasury, behind Lincoln's back, using all the patronage of the Treasury to try to unseat a sitting president. Rather awkward. But as Lincoln said, in rather colloquial terms, Chase had the presidential maggot eating at him, and just just could not get it out. So eventually Chase had to go. But the other members of his cabinet were anything but rivals. I mean, William Seward had been a rival for the nomination, but very quickly Seward becomes Lincoln's right-hand man. And what's more, the other members of the cabinet are very loyal to Lincoln. Maybe in the long term, what's striking is that Lincoln includes nobody of an opposite political perspective. Everyone who comes into Lincoln's cabinet, they might be rivals, but it's very inter-family rivals. He includes no one of a pro-slavery or pro-secession point of view. And what's more, when Lincoln, throughout Lincoln's administration, he's very much in charge of the cabinet. It's very interesting to see that from the election of 1800 up until 1860, cabinets had been growing and growing in terms of power in American administrations, almost to the point where by the 1850s there were some cabinet secretaries who almost were overshadowing the President of the United States. Lincoln puts an absolute stop to that. There is never any question but that Lincoln is in complete charge of all policy matters. And one of his secretaries, John Hay, records in his diary how, "I never understood until this time," he's writing in 1863, "how thoroughly in charge of everything Lincoln really is. He's like a backwoods Jupiter launching his thunderbolts." And Secretary Chase is the first to complain, because Chase says, "Lincoln treats us as nothing but heads of departments. We come into cabinet meetings, no one debates anything, no one deliberates over anything. Lincoln says, I've made these decisions, you, and you are going to carry them out," which offended Chase a great deal. So, team of rivals, again, I'm not certain we're on entirely the same ground when we're talking about Lincoln. And now the situation which confronts Senator Obama, where in fact he really may be looking at a cabinet full of rivals, most principally Senator Clinton. And what is a curiosity, I think, for many people is that for a candidate who had campaigned on the platform of change, what the cabinet is now really starting to look like something which hasn't changed very much at all from the last Clinton administration. And I have a concern that Senator Obama, as president, is going to sit down at the cabinet table and everyone's eyes are going to swivel not onto him, but onto Senator Clinton, because they were all people who had served in the Clinton administration. And that, as you can imagine, can create quite a great deal of political trouble in the context of the American political system. So again, apples and oranges.
Thank you. Oh, yes.
Sorry, I want to ask you a question about
can
what you said during the lecture, but given your remarks about comparisons between today and the 1860s, wouldn't it be better to say that the true parallel is probably between Lincoln and George W., insofar as both are elected for two terms, both are defined by a war. Lincoln, as Bush can be accused and was accused of starting the war under legally ambiguous circumstances. At the end, habeas corpus is suspended. People are put into jail for a couple of years and not told what charges. In the end, also, you get a very ambiguous legacy of that war insofar as Reconstruction is sort of watched, and then result is on for a century of the blacks still being in a subordinate position, a secondary position in the States. So it looks to me he's more like Bush than Obama. But that's not what I really want to
say. Well, I should interject and say that at this point, it sounds like the comparison tends to move that Mr. Bush tends to resemble all the mistakes Lincoln made, whereas Obama is supposed to represent all the good things that Lincoln made. I don't know about that. but pray continue.
Yeah.
But I mean, that strikes me as a more realistic comparison. But anyways, when you were saying that Lincoln changes his mind legally, I mean, when he writes to Fremont, he actually says that not even the President of the United States could introduce emancipation by martial law. "I would be a dictator," he says in his letter to Fremont,
mm-hmm.
"if I did this."
That's right.
Which is exactly what he does.
Exactly, a year later.
Exactly what he does.
Yeah, to a debt, yes.
Now, your explanation for this is that he's under pressure from McClellan, and that's the key reason why he begins to move towards emancipation. Others more recently have taken a kind of different tack and have argued that the reason he moves is that he has to, because the blacks are emancipating themselves in the areas where the Union Army is going in. And
who is doing the forcing? Because if you have to ask the question, are slaves self-emancipating and thereby they're creating some kind of political force that compels Lincoln to act? Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first question you have to ask is, how many slaves self-emancipated? And the answer to that is twofold. One answer is probably not more than about 200,000. The other answer is zero. And the reason that there's two answers is, first of all, in terms of slaves who run away, we don't have anything that even remotely approximates an accurate count. No one was keeping record. Because for one thing, it was very fluid. A slave is not going to run away, then show up in Kentucky or show up in Ohio ardently saying, I was once a slave, I just ran away, and now I'm here. What are you going to do with me? For all that he knew, they were liable to pack him up and send him back.
Well, did they just enlist him and send him?
Well, they did. In fact, McClellan did that himself. He issued orders that the army was not to permit slaves to run away to Union Army camps, and if they did, they were to be returned on demand to their owners. So General Butler at Fortress Monroe is actually an exception to the rule in giving aid and comfort to those who are fleeing slavery. General Halleck, General Buell, General McClellan, all of these people who were in charge in 1861 and 1862 won't have anything to do at all with the idea of slaves finding refuge in Union Army camps. The only worthwhile numbers I have seen on this appear in Lewis Gertheis's book, From Contraband to Freedom, in which, piecing together reports from various places, Gertheis's estimate is that maximum, perhaps about 287,000 slaves, escaped on their own, made their own way to freedom. Mm-hmm. And that's curiously close to an estimate that Secretary of State Seward made in 1865 when he was asked how many slaves did he believe had actually been literally emancipated by the proclamation. He said about 200,000. Now, when you think about it, there are 3.9 million slaves. We're not talking about a huge percentage. We're not talking about a tsunami of political influence, which then leads me to the zero number. Because, all right, let us suppose that some 200,000 slaves have run away. First of all, the fact of running away does not make them free. It might make them free de facto, but it does not make them free de jure. Doesn't make them free under law. Simply means they are mislaid property under law, under state law. They can be rendered up, they can be retrieved, and if at any moment during the war some kind of negotiated peace between North and South, between the Union and the Confederacy, had been achieved, should we imagine that Southern slaveholders would not have put in a claim for either financial recompense or the return of their slaves? They did this after the American Revolution. They did this after the War of 1812. When you consider the amount of capital investment that slaves represented, I mean, do not lay that flattering unction to your soul. These are people who are quite desperate to get their hands back on their property. So had there been anything that fell short of a complete Union victory, something which was not entirely clear until 1865, that could have easily happened. So what is the political mass exerted by these runaway slaves? Well, the answer is zero, because they're still slaves. They're not free, de jure. And then, even if we were to concede that slaves who had run away and managed to find new homes in the North were some kind of political force, what kind of political force? Because except in a few pockets here and there in the North, blacks, whether slave or free, cannot vote. There is no political movement that blacks can be part of. They can be ignored quite routinely. Worse than ignored, they can be beaten up upon, they can be rioted against. This is why there were the draft riots of 1863 in New York City, which were actually one only of a series of urban riots like that in the summer of 1863, really turned quite quickly from being riots against the federal draft to being anti-black lynch mobs. There's no protection. So my question then becomes, taking all these things together, exactly what was the nature of this influence which is supposed to have forced Lincoln's hand to emancipation? Weigh in the balances against that, the fact that when Lincoln does issue the Emancipation Proclamation, the preliminary one in September of 1862, He is 6 weeks away from the congressional by-elections, and the message of the congressional by-elections is, not a good idea, we don't like it. There was really a lot of uncertainty leading up to January 1st, 1863, that Lincoln was really going to go through with it, that Lincoln was really going to sign it, which of course he did. But it was, the whole context of it was that uncertain.
Hang on, there's so many people who want to ask questions.
I'm sorry.
Could I just join up a couple of questions?
Yes.
Here first and then at the back. Yeah, please. And speak up.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for your lecture. And during your talk, I found it interesting that you emphasized Lincoln's personal agency in the event that transpired. And you also mentioned how he focused, perhaps like no other president, the powers of the presidency around himself, and he emphasized that. And so I was hoping to sort of to invoke another great and not unrelated historical event. And I wondered whether your personal opinion, whether there's any justice in some historians' opinion that Lincoln can be defined, even if only constitutionally, as a tyrant or a dictator. And that's something that's really
important. There's one more question at the back there. Yeah, please.
My question is on the point whether Lincoln was forced to do that. And I think in this context, the comment by Navy Secretary Gideon Wells in his diary is usually very reliable, is interesting, who says that Lincoln considered making the declaration earlier, but then withheld it for several months because he said, we need a victory. If we do it after defeat, the political message will be one of desperation. So we need to wait with the declaration until we have scored sort of a victory on the battlefield, and only then can we put this forward. So I think your interpretation that it is only a completely legal move is also not the whole story. And furthermore, the international perspective, which you say did not play a role, I think it was not the main reason, but it certainly did play a role. And it had a massive effect in England. And all the agents of the Confederacy in England said, this is it. All our attempts to get a majority in Parliament for breaking the blockade have to be abandoned. We no longer have a chance to get that.
Let me disagree with that, because if you look very closely at the history of the Palmerston government, especially in its dealings with the United States, Palmerston in general and Lord John Russell, as foreign minister in particular, were extremely worried about the American situation. First of all, because it was disrupting the supply of cotton to the English textile mills. And this, of course, is the foundation of the Industrial Revolution. So that's like saying it's disrupting the supply of oil in the modern industrial context. Well, what then should Great Britain do as a result? Well, the question then becomes, well, we ought to intervene. We ought to get these two quarreling parties sat down at a table and tell them how they need to arrange things. What makes this, what puts an added edge to this is the fear, the atmosphere of fear in the cabinet, that if Lincoln pushed ahead with emancipation, the next step after emancipation was going to be some violent racial bloodbath, that what you would get would be something akin to the Indian Mutiny. And Britain, having only just moved through 1857, 1858, and seen the results of what was fundamentally a racial war in India, there the question again forces itself on the minds of the British cabinet to say, can we stand idly beside and see this kind of disruption in North America tricked by an emancipation proclamation? Because again, the assumption is very routine. Emancipation, the next thing which will happen will be some kind of race war. And the fear of that pervades the commentary in the cabinet from Lord John Russell, from the Secretary of State for War, George Cornwall. And Cornwall in particular is very concerned about this, but it is Cornwall, not Palmerston, not Russell, who is the one who is saying, wait, we can't fight this kind of war. We can't insert ourselves militarily into North America. We'll become much too overextended. One other member of the cabinet is much more notorious for his extremism on behalf of the Confederacy, and that is William Ewart Gladstone. And Gladstone makes a speech that everyone wishes he hadn't made in October of 1862, when he says, well, not only is Jefferson Davis and the Confederates, not only have they made a government, but they made an army, they made a navy, they have made a nation, which was routinely read as some kind of quasi-official cabinet endorsement of the Confederacy. So the fear in Lincoln's mind was, if we in fact do move to emancipation, maybe that will enlist the sympathy of British abolitionists, but at the same time, it might trigger a response from the Palmerston government, which would say, well, we have to intervene because this reckless madman Lincoln is going to, is in the process of provoking a continental racial war. I think that's connected in some respects to the question of was Lincoln a tyrant? Because Lincoln does assume powers that no president had ever assumed before. And he's conscious of this. At the same time, the curiosity is that he comes to the presidency as a one-time Whig. And the Whigs, of course, have been the party of presidential minimalism. Their bogeyman had been Andrew Jackson, the military chieftain. So here now, Lincoln comes into office, and he immediately has to assume precisely the kinds of powers that are associated with Jackson. What's curious in this regard is watching Lincoln's behavior. Lincoln will take certain chances in terms of suspending habeas corpus, in terms of issuing this unprecedented presidential proclamation. He'll do things like, but at the same time, he'll also go back to his attorney general and ask for an opinion in writing about whether he should grant a license to a particular saloon keeper in the District of Columbia. You get this back and forth. He's clearly on uncharted water. When Secretary of the Treasury Chase presses him in September of 1863 to say, go ahead and emancipate the slaves in the border states and the occupied areas as well, Lincoln's response is, I haven't been elected to implement my personal preferences. If I tried to, would I not be in the boundless fields of despotism? He was conscious that what he was doing looked like despotism, but his intention was 180 degrees the other way. I think what's curious, too, is that as soon as the emergency of civil war is over, immediately the entire federal government dials down. In fact, the day that Ulysses Grant receives the surrender of Robert E. Lee and Appomattox, one of the first things that Grant does is start issuing orders for demobilization of the army. He said, well, I've got to save money. And you move through this, and immediately there's this instinct. The entire federal government kind of collapses back so that, and I was saying this to my wife today, we were walking down by the Houses of Parliament. We're walking past Horse Guards Parade and seeing all these great buildings which are the testaments of empire, while reflecting on the fact that in the United States government, the entire Department of State, the Department of War, and the Department of the Interior were all housed in one building beside the White House through the balance of the 19th century. But, so if there was this exponential growth in time of war, it, as soon as the war was over, shrank right back to these very minimal standards. Lincoln himself never employed more than 6 secretaries. That was his staff. He had 6 people. My suspicion is that General Wolseley and General Roberts, whose monuments are there at Horse Guards Parade, certainly did not go on campaign with staff smaller than 6 people. But here's the President of the United States going at it. And it did help that he was a workaholic.
Yes, there's one question over there. Any others want to ask a question?
I was wondering what you think of the book, The Real Abraham Lincoln, by Newton in 47, because he sort of gives...
You mean Joseph Fort Newton?
No, Newton. L-U-T-H-I-N from Columbia University. He wrote a book, The Real Abraham Lincoln.
Well, there have been a couple of books with that title, one of them by Jesse Wyke in 1927,
right.
And then a more recent one.
This is 1947.
And that I'll have to confess a total blank about it. Would you give me a quick synthesis, something I haven't permitted anyone else to do today?
Well, he sort of goes over the whole career of Lincoln, but sort of looking at him as a sort of typical sort of pork barrel politician. But at the same time, if you like, still applauding him, seeing the good in him. And he sort of says he was very impetuous. For instance, in McClellan's, sacking McClellan, you see, because McClellan didn't want to make an offensive. So the next person forced to make an offensive had a disastrous effect.
Yes, and that is a good point and well taken, because Lincoln is constantly trying to push McClellan. A great engineer, great military engineer, Lincoln once said that McClellan's great talent as an engineer was for stationary engines. And Lincoln had a number of good zingers at McClellan at his expense. But McClellan was what they called a target-rich environment. The man was really quite full of himself. And Lincoln had a lot of fun that way. But seriously, he does lean hard on McClellan, get moving, get moving, get moving. And when Lincoln doesn't, when McClellan doesn't, Lincoln sacks him. His successor, Ambrose Burnside, immediately has the same pressure, and Burnside, to his credit, within 2 weeks has the entire Army of the Potomac in motion, the army that McClellan insisted could not be put into motion. Burnside gets them into motion, crosses the Rappahannock River at Fredericksburg, and leads them into a colossal disaster. And you do have to wonder, is that disaster a product of Lincoln prodding too much? That maybe, at least as a military engineer, there was something to be said for stationary engines. But that's a valid point. I have often wondered, by the way, and there are many ways to sing the praises of Abraham Lincoln. He was a remarkable man. He was a very complex, a very private man. He's one of those rare American political figures of real intellectual substance, of very broad reading, surprisingly for a man of minimal education. And yet, hidden within the complexity, there could be these impulses which don't always seem to point in the most fruitful directions. And untangling the man is really worthy of cleaning the Orion stables. I mean, there's wells of secrecy within the man, very private man, very unforthcoming. And a man of melancholy disposition, some would say almost of clinical depression. And yet he manages to combine all these things into being a very successful politician. So you take him together, and probably the most remarkable testimony about him comes from John Hay. John Hay was his second secretary in the White House. John Hay was a young whippersnapper right out of Brown University who knew everything, as people tend to do when they're 22 years old. But he knew everything. And he goes to work for Lincoln. And 2 years into this job in the White House, Hay has this most remarkable statement. Says, you know, I'm so surprised by Lincoln. I mean, here's a man who combines gentleness and firmness, who combines iron and tenderness, and in such a remarkable way that I never really understood him before. I think God has put him in this place. And when you consider that most 22 to 24 year olds, you know, the more they get to know their boss, the less they hold them in esteem. Yeah. That's actually a pretty remarkable comment coming from John Hay, who actually esteemed Lincoln more for knowing him as he did.
I want to thank you again on behalf of LSE Ideas, on behalf of the whole audience who've been enjoying your lecture tonight, for a brilliant presentation. And for taking questions from the audience. We enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much.
It worked.
now all the southern ports closed. They're no longer ports of entry, so we don't have to blockade them.
There's another distinction. There's the distinction between closure of ports and blockade. Because, again, in American writing about the Civil War, there's just no comprehension of the distinction. Nothing that takes it back to the Napoleonic system, or drives me around in circles. You are doing a splendid job with that. That is great. Send us some stuff about that. I'm very, very good. Ah, wonderful, wonderful. Well, good.